Today on the show, comedian and author Wayne Fetterman talks about the history of stand-up.
You read the book. What do you think?
You're a professor and you're giving me a pop quiz. That's what's happening.
I'm giving you a pop quiz.
The Daily Detour.
I'm Dan Roberts. Welcome into The Daily Detour. I always like to start with good news, and I guess the good news is that stand-up comedy is slowly coming back across the country. I love stand-up. It's the first thing I missed when everything shut down during this pandemic, and it's what I'm looking forward to the most now that I'm almost fully vaccinated. I was worried about going back to the clubs and stuff. I think I'll be a lot more relaxed once I get that second shot. And there are a lot of great comedians coming to my neck of the woods, so probably near you as well if things are opening up where you're at. Sam Morrell is on the road. I know Whitney Cummings is making the rounds. Spokane's own Kelsey Cook. Ari Spears from Mad TV. My very favorite guy on Twitter, Mark Norman. So you get the idea. Stand-up comedy is coming back, is the point. But where did it come from in the first place? That is the subject of today's podcast. Wayne Fetterman is our guest today. He is a stand-up, he's an actor, author, professor at USC, musician, and podcaster. In other words, overachiever. He's appeared multiple times on The Tonight Show. I believe was the head writer or head monologue writer?
Head monologue writer. Get it right.
Yeah. Yes, with Jimmy Fallon.
Don't exaggerate my credits, please.
He co-produced the Emmy-winning documentary, The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling, which had a profound effect on, I think, a lot of people that I know who are Gary Shandling fans. Me and other people. God, I got a comedian on with me. This is going to be rough.
Yes, of course.
And Wayne has acted in numerous films and TV shows, including Legally Blonde, Knocked Up, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Curb Your Enthusiasm, The Larry Sanders Show with Guess Who, Gary Shandling, and The X-Files, and a Geico commercial with Kenny Rogers, which could not go without mentioning.
Thank you for remembering that.
Yeah, currently you can listen to him on the History of Stand-Up podcast, and you can check out his new book, which is what we're here to talk about today, which is indeed The History of Stand-Up from Mark Twain to Dave Chappelle.
Yes.
Mark Fetterman, welcome. Yes.
Thank you. That was quite an introduction. Quite an intro. We don't only have to talk about the book, I promise. The book is out and I'm thrilled with it and people are buying it, but I just feel like I don't want to be like, oh, buy my book. I don't want to be that
right.
guy.
Yeah. Yeah, self-promotion is a tough thing, right? In a way.
Well, I just feel like if we have a good time and it's entertaining, whatever, what are we doing? 12 minutes? How long is this thing?
I think we were expecting an hour or less.
Oh, an hour. That's right. I'm sorry. It's an hour. Yeah, I'm ready. So,
But I'm fascinated by, I listened to your podcast and enjoyed it. I've read the book now. I'm fascinated by the history of stand-up.
All right, let's do it. What era are you most fascinated by?
Well, clearly I grew up in the 70s and 80s. I'm fascinated with all of that. But also, I have a real affection, being a radio guy, I have an affection for, you know, I didn't get into radio to be Wolfman Jack or Casey Kasem, really, but that's what radio became. But when I was growing up, you know, they were releasing some of these old radio programs like the Green Hornet and Baby Snooks or Schnooks.
All that stuff. Sandy Bryce. I'm very familiar. I love old time radio. So
And Sirius XM nicely has a whole channel devoted to that stuff. So now I can enjoy it again. So, I mean, just the whole thing with stand up. My first question really is, why did you decide to write this book? Was there none available previously?
No, there's never really been anyone that's connected the dots from pre-vaudeville era, the comics that were working there, to Maria Bamford, who's working today. No one has ever done that. So I was like, well, I do a podcast. I know this story. I wrote it during COVID. Right. And yeah, so I just, that's sort of what it is. I wanted it to be, there's been a lot of books written about stand-up comedy, but none the history of it. It's all, this era. Like, it's really interesting to me that, like, some authors are like, the 70s was the golden age. And then the very next book, Seriously Funny by Gerald Nachman, is like, we lost our way in the 70s. The 50s and 60s were the way. I was like, okay, guys, can we just Stop with the bickering already. Right. So I don't do anything like what's the greatest decade or who's the greatest comic or anything like that. I just tell the story and try to connect everyone. I try to connect. That's that. I would say that's my mission statement for the book, was connecting all of it.
So what do you hope people take away from it? What do you hope that they learn?
Well, I hope that they understand that, one, that stand-up comedy has been around a long time, even though it wasn't called stand-up comedy for almost 100 years. Two, that it's generational, that it's kind of unfair to be like, I don't get Mort Saul. I don't understand. Like, the people doing stand-up comedy are for you right now.
Right.
The people that did it in the past were for those generations of audiences. So, of course, it's going to have a different rhythm. It's going to have a different jargon. It's going to, you'll be able to talk about different things now than you could back then. And so it's a very generational art form. It doesn't have a long shelf life, except for a few. But as a rule, it doesn't have a long shelf life.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Well, whose material has stood the test of time? Or is it as isolated as a joke? It's not even like their act, but maybe some jokes have...
It's completely subjective. In 1956, there's a comedian named Steve Allen. He wrote a book. He had just, I guess he had just finishing up hosting The Tonight Show. He's the first host of The Tonight Show. And he wrote a book called The Funny Man, where he kind of like broke down comedy. And the very beginning of the book is so prescient. He just goes, you know, I did a survey. And some people are like, oh, you think Jack Benny is still funny? You think George Gope? Like, it's completely subjective.
Yeah.
So obviously in poll after poll, like Richard Pryor seems to keep coming up as the top comedian, and I would vote for that. But I could understand someone saying, oh, I like Bill Burr, or I like Jonathan Winters did.
Yeah.
You know, so there is no, I don't know. There's no answer. What do you think?
Well, I think that you mentioned Jack Benny, and I think Jack Benny still works. You got to adjust your thinking to the, But it's the personality, right? That's why it works for me if I listen. But I also, it's like comparing a movie. It's like saying this movie you grew up on doesn't hold up to today's standards. You kind of got to adjust your
expectations. Yeah, of course. You know, I mean, it's true with all art. Look, that's true with almost all art, with the exception of the fine art, like paintings and sculptures. I feel like those are like, oh, what Rodin did is still great. And what, you know, Van Gogh did was incredible. So yeah. I'm trying to think of another artist. I can't. That's how sad it is. John Singer Sargent, that is his name. That guy was incredible. So I don't know. That's not what my book is about. My book is not about like, oh, you need to really appreciate what Mort Saul did in 1953 if you love comedy. It's not that in any way. Right. It's just I want you to know who Mort Saul was and why he's important to the development of stand-up. That's it. Oh, I sound so serious.
But a side effect could be that people will find an interest in maybe people they haven't heard of or didn't know enough about, and maybe they'll go seek out some of that stuff. I thought the Will Rogers line about Democrats held up. And I'm a Democrat, I just thought that was funny.
Yeah, no, I mean, I put like four lines from comedians in the book. The book is not about like, oh, here's a line from this comedian, and I don't have any of that stuff in there. But Will Rogers, just because he was so influential to political comedy, which is huge now. I mean, it's huge. When you think about late night comedy, it's so politically charged.
Yeah.
It used to be Carson would do two or three jokes and then move on to other stuff. But now it's the whole show. It's the first segment. That's all basically from Will Rogers.
Do you think that's driven by the hosts, or do you think the audience has that as strong an appetite as the hosts do?
I don't know. I think what happened is as the audience shares got smaller, they realized, oh, I could have a dedicated group of people who think the same way I do, still do a talk show, which is something Carson, I have a great quote. It's not in the book, but about like it's a real danger to put your political views out as host of these shows. And now it's almost like if you don't, you're not a good host. So it's like it has completely turned around. But don't forget, Carson had a way bigger audience and was trying to reach the entire country. So now I feel like these shows aren't trying to reach the whole country. They're trying to keep a dedicated group of people.
I find that interesting because they are still broadcasting. Like I get it on, even on a cable channel, definitely get it on streaming and on demand on podcasts, but it seems like I don't know. It seems like it's still somewhat dangerous on a broadcast network, but they're
really, you feel like Stephen Colbert, you don't know where he stands politically.
Well, that's true. I don't have to watch it. I know exactly where he stands. And if I don't like it, I don't have to watch.
Well, I'm just saying it's not about you particularly. I'm just saying in general, do not know where he stands. So,
yeah.
But did you know where, where Carson or Steve Allen or any of those other guys, Paupar,
I come from the school of thought that I don't really care if it's funny. Like I'm so Mad Magazine, Saturday Night Live, anti-establishment. Yeah. I expect people to punch up towards authority. But you can get into trouble with people that aren't open-minded, I guess, for sure. That's all I got.
Okay, I like it.
All right. Well, tell me about the beginnings of stand-up, starting with Artemis Ward. Who is Artemis Ward?
Well, what did you get at? You read the book. What do you think of Artemis Ward? I read my whole book.
Well, you're supposed to tell me about it. I think people don't know that name. I certainly didn't. But
okay,
he was a guy. Now, he was the newspaper guy, right?
All right.
Yeah. You're testing me.
No, I'm not. I didn't mean it that way.
You're a professor, and you're giving me a pop quiz. That's what's happening.
I'm giving you a pop quiz. Let me hear. I want to have a conversation as opposed to just you go and tell us this whole chapter or something like that.
Yeah.
That's all I'm trying to do. I'm sorry. I'm a jerk. I'm the worst. Yeah, I'm a terrible guest.
No, you're fantastic. you're just making me sweat more than other guests. That's fine.
Yeah.
So he was a newspaper guy who people thought was very funny. He became very famous over a short period of time in an age without internet. It was thanks to newspapers.
Yeah, newspaper was the internet of the... Look at us. We're teaching right now. Internet of the day. And here was the interesting thing. At the time, unlike now, like let's say you write a funny column for the, San Francisco Tribune or something like that. If they have to run that in the New York Times or the Washington Post, they have to pay you. But back then, the government said, we're trying to get people to learn to read. We want a smart middle class so we can excel as a country. So at the time, any article could be repurposed for your newspaper without any compensation. So that's one of the reasons. It's a little thing that's changed now. That somebody like Artemis Ward, whose little funny columns that were actually letters, fake letters, spread all over the country. So interesting to me. It is. Interesting to one person.
No, it is interesting. The other thing that's interesting about it is that people started reciting his, like taking his jokes and performing them live, which he didn't know was happening. And then he's like, I guess, if they can do it, I can do it better. I wrote it, I can come up with new material.
You know the history of stand-up. Yeah. So the weird thing is he was a very shy kind of guy. So he bought a book on public speaking. Believe it or not, in the 1850s, there were books on public speaking. So he bought a book on public speaking because he wanted to, be able to stand on stage. And he quit his job at the newspaper, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, still around. And then he moved to New York City. Started writing for Vanity Fair, which was then a comedy magazine.
Yeah, that freaked me out a little bit. That surprised me. overstating it, but
yeah, that was a surprise me. My God, you just see you running around the house, hands up in the air.
My wife had to calm me down.
Exactly. Get some hot compresses. This guy is freaked out. What did he just read? Was it something about a new strain of coronavirus? Oh, no. Oh, Vanity Fair was the comedy. That's awesome. And then he decided to try to do this on stage. And he had a really brilliant idea, genius idea, which was, I'm going to do a lecture, because this was during the time of lectures. Everyone would do these TED Talks. They were like hour-long TED Talks.
And they were
anything.
Considered entertainment at the time, like a new form of entertainment, which is sort of an odd way to describe a lecture.
It was called elevated entertainment. So it was like people would pay to learn about botany, biology, the Revolutionary War, experts on any number of subjects. And they would crisscross the country. It was called the Lyceum Movement. They had it was all movement. It's a weird thing. First of all, I don't like the word movement anyway for obvious reasons, but to call something a movement is weird, but it was called the Lyceum Movement, and it happened.
Which doesn't make it sound any better.
I know. Lyceum doesn't really improve this. So anyway, Ward was like, okay, all of these are serious lectures about serious things. And so he does this lecture called Stories About the Baby, and his whole lecture is a misdirect. He never once addresses the topic of
right.
his lecture. So the whole, it's all tangents and a tangent of a tangent. And he did it in a very obvious, from what I've read, I didn't see him. I never opened for him. I never do.
It was a way back.
Yeah. This is 1860, 1861. He was very deadpan, which is surprising because he was in theaters and there was no microphones then, obviously. Right. So he must have had some kind of voice that carried.
Yeah.
And it became a sensation, and he toured the country as a humorous lecturer and made tens of thousands of dollars. I mean, could charge 50 cents or a dollar a seat, play like a 800-seat theater. That's $800 back then. That's pretty good. That's huge. Yeah. That's huge. And then he goes to England, you know, 1800s, gets tuberculosis and dies. Classic, old school, 1800s, way to die.
Right.
But before he dies, he meets Samuel Clemens, and Clemens sees the lecture and is like, oh, I have a character I created called Mark Twain.
Yeah.
You know? Maybe I could tour as Mark Twain. And that's how the Mark Twain lectures, which became even bigger than anything Artemus Ward could have imagined.
Right.
It was like, oh, now there's guys playing Madison Square Garden. Like, oh, you could do it on this level. So that was Twain. And so Twain just took it to a whole different level and toured the whole world. Austria, Hungary, England.
It sounds like he was a rock star before.
Yes.
Before Steve Martin was the rock star comic.
Well, there was no rock music back then.
That's
so
true.
It's weird to call him that. But I guess you could call him the...
Maybe there was. Maybe it fell out of favor and then it was rediscovered.
You're right.
Let's rewrite history right now.
The book, in a weird way, is from Artemus Ward to Dave Chappelle, but nobody knows who the hell Artemus Ward is. A lot of people know who Mark Twain is. They give the Mark Twain prize. That's why he's on the cover of my book and not poor Artemus.
I could go so many directions here. I got to follow up with the microphone first, though, because that's sort of all you imagine when you think of stand-up is this wall behind me and then a microphone. But the microphone wasn't around right away. It wasn't around until radio. Is that basically the time?
Network radio starts in 26. Yes, that's about the time they started putting speaker systems into movie theaters because something was coming called the talkies. Up until that time, they called them silent movies. They were never really silent because they usually had a piano player or an orchestra or an organist or something like that accompany the picture. They used to call them moving pictures. But then when sound started coming around, 26, 27, 25, 26, 27, obviously there was a huge movie called The Jazz Singer from Warner Brothers, 1927, yes. Al Jolson, that sort of kicked off. And they were like, oh, my God, this is going. So now every movie, every theater had to have a sound system. Once you had a sound system, it was easy enough just to have a microphone and then we're off to the races.
Right. We still have these discussions about what's going to kill television, what's killing radio, blah, blah, blah. But radio actually did kill vaudeville in a
partially,
way. Right?
Partially. Yeah. One of the. Yeah. But I think it was. Yes. It was one of the many talking pictures, radio, which was free entertainment. And this is another example of the government, like, radio is going to be free. Like, that's going to be our deal. Like, the FCC, all of that was created, like, make sure radio is free. Because we were in a depression when it really kind of kicked in. And so they wanted people to get entertainment directly into their home. All they had to do was buy this one piece of equipment.
And news and information, I would assume, was for the government to be interested in getting their message out, right?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, obviously, if you think about Franklin Roosevelt, he becomes president in 1933, uses radio immediately. He had this thing called why are we talking about politics?
I don't know.
Weird. I know. But he had this thing called the fireside chats. So he immediately was able to use radio to get his message out and to promote his New Deal policies. So... radio, I write it in the book, very interesting, like, just imagine how insane it was when radio first happened. There was these invisible waves floating in the air, not through a wire, could pass through a wall, could pass through your front door like the plague in from the Bible or something. Go into your radio, and then you could hear a
program. Is that how they marketed it? It's like a plague from the Bible for your entertainment.
That's right. I don't think NBC was doing that. But you know what I mean? It was just like
NBC, proud as a plague.
Right? Hey, you enjoyed Boyles. You enjoyed Locust. You might enjoy Eddie Cantor this Sunday night at 7 p.m. So, I mean, just think about it. Never before in the history of humanity has there been anything like it.
Yeah. It's still magic to me. Like, I'm not a scientist. I'm not an engineer. So
No. What else aren't you?
I can go through the list A to Z.
Do it.
But yeah, back then, to have media come out of nowhere like that, all you're used to is print media. It's wild.
It is wild. And for the first time in human existence, thousands of people could hear the same voice at the same time, miles apart. How's that sound? Dramatic.
It does sound dramatic.
I should write a book about radio. Very into it.
You could. That could be a follow-up.
No. Believe me, it's covered. It's covered. A lot of people have written.
More with my guest, Wayne Fetterman, coming up after this word from our sponsor.
On the next Silent Comedy Podcast, The Genius of Charlie Chaplin. The daring of Buster Keaton. And the timeless teamwork of Laurel and Hardy. We'll also take a look at this underrated gal. What a looker. And funny, too. The Silent Comedy Podcast. There's no other podcast like it.
All right, that was a completely legitimate sponsor. Well worth interrupting our conversation with comedian Wayne Fetterman for. Let's continue with the history of stand-up.
I learned a lot of stuff. I learned the difference between vaudeville and burlesque, both of which I enjoy. I'm a big Alice Cooper fan, which I seem to tell everyone that I talk with. And he compares what he does to vaudeville, why he says like Groucho Marx and George Burns and guys like that got his act because they knew it was just vaudeville. While he was, you know, while parents were outraged and panicked and worried that he was the devil himself, you know, those guys knew, oh, I get it. This is shtick. This is vaudeville. So,
of course.
And then burlesque has the ladies and the tops coming nearly off and stuff like that, the pasties. So.
Yeah. And that's where we have is the sort of grandmother, I'm going to call it, of this current day strip clubs. And I will say, if there's one area of the book, as I look back and I reread it, and I'm disgusted at some of my usage, is that I feel like I should have written a little more about strip clubs and their influence in stand-up comedy. So that's because they're around for a long time. Leno did them. Joan Rivers emceed a strip club. Obviously, Lenny Bruce became famous working strip clubs out here in Los Angeles. But even Gabe Kaplan, the guy who, Mr. Cotter, I don't know if you know, Welcome Back, Cotter.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, he worked strip clubs. In fact, he worked the famous strip club in Dallas where Ruby was the owner.
Oh, wow.
And he ended up shooting. Yeah, so it was a scene, and you get a little bonus content here.
We'll make a bookmark that people can print out with the additional information. And
as you know, my book is not that long. It's like 160 pages. It's a lot. It's 160 years, 160 pages. So it's like a lot to cover.
Right.
I kind of wish I had spent a couple paragraphs at least on strip clubs.
Yeah, well, maybe that's the next book.
Yes.
That'll be a fun one.
Radio and Strip Clubs by Wayne Fetterman.
Hey, they're not strangers to each other either, so there's that. I can't imagine, so was it more burlesque in those strip clubs? Like, at what point did it become like a modern-day strip club? Because I can't imagine going to a modern-day strip club and sitting through comedians like...
Right.
You know what I mean? It would.
I know. It seems weird that it would even be a place where a comedian could work. Because it was just a bunch of guys who wanted to see or have a girl. I'm not an expert on exactly that world, but I do know that in the 30s, they started stripping a little bit more. And the mayor of New York, a guy named LaGuardia, you can still fly into his airport, kind of shut down the big time burlesque business in New York in the late 30s and just thought it was too reprehensible. Because the girls were really, and again, they weren't even stripped. They were kind of like, they were teasing.
It's a tease.
They're stripped. Yeah. So it wasn't like now where it's like, hello, I'm already seeing too much.
Yeah.
And then it kind of drove underground. But even for years at strip clubs, there were acts in strip clubs. There would be like Lenny Bruce's wife, Honey, whatever her name was. She was an act, and she would get booked like a comic or something in different strip clubs for like a week's engagement or something. Now it's just who's ever there. You know, it's not like, you get to see, what do they call them? They always use car names for these strippers now. You get to see Camaro O'Neill this week only at West End Strip Club.
Yeah.
Like, so they didn't book out. So there was still a show business aspect to strip clubs, even in the 50s and maybe even in the 70s, I would say.
Yeah.
Probably by the 80s, it was like, we're just going to put a bar up and there's just going to be a hot girl and that's all you need to know.
Dancing to
stripper pole. I didn't mean bar.
Dancing to Pour Some Sugar on Me for the third decade in a row or fourth decade in a row.
Man, that's a good one. That song is so good.
I love burlesque though, and I'm glad that it has made a niche comeback. And there's a whole club in Seattle called the Triple Door.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about it.
I think that's mostly what they do there. But they're like these thematic. They'll put on like the burlesque version of Cinderella or something
that.
Yeah. Funny. And it's well done, you know, and I've gone to burlesque shows and they've had like fire performers as one of the acts. It's a true variety experience. And like every two acts or something, you get the girl teasing.
Okay, well, there's your answer. It was like you just said you couldn't imagine seeing a show with strippers and comics.
Right. But I can't imagine today. I can't imagine when Jay Leno got there, it had to be more like it is now. Right. Except they still had comedy somehow.
Still had comedy. I mean, don't forget, they still, before the Pour Some Sugar on Me and the playing with the DJ, you know, coming up next, LaVonica, you know, before that guy, they had bands that played strip clubs. They had little quartets.
Yeah.
So to play the music.
Right. Well, and that's fun, too. And I experienced that in Vegas. I did. There was I can't remember what club it was. It was in Treasure Island. I don't think it's around anymore, but they had a lounge and a girl would come out and dance on the bar. And then there was like a 3-piece band playing her music, heavy percussion and upright bass, which is, I mean, I'm sorry, but it's very cool to me.
I guess it was. It's a whole different vibe than listening to like You Shook Me All Night Long or something like that.
Yeah.
And it is a throwback to that era. And here's another thing. Not only did Lenny Bruce meet his wife, Honey, but through the band members that he hung out with, that's where he first scored his heroin. Because you know musicians and heroin, they love it.
Not to generalize.
They can't get enough of it.
What do you think about Lenny's portrayal in the Fabulous Mrs. Maisel?
I assume you're talking about the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel?
Marvelous! Yes, it's been... Hey, I feel like it's been on hiatus for 2 years now, so it's slipping out of my head.
I like that you're blaming the show because you don't know the name of it. All right. Interesting move. I get names wrong all the time. So I'm the last person.
Something hit me. Person. It's the last couple of years, man. The memory's starting to F with me, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I hear you, brother. I hear you.
Do you think that's an accurate portrayal of Lenny?
Well, it's not accurate, and that was what Lenny Bruce was doing at the time in his career in the Village. But I think that's the best portrayal of Lenny Bruce I've ever seen on film. I think it's better than Dustin Hoffman's. I think it's better than I didn't see Cliff Gorman on Broadway do Lenny, so I can't compare it to that. But that guy is tremendous.
And what
he's
about
the tremendous Mrs. Maisel?
Yeah. I think I said fabulous. I don't know.
Yeah, I know. I upped you.
What about the whole Mrs. Maisel just in general as far as stand-up goes? The one thing I would say is they don't show her really writing the material. It just seems like this spontaneous thing that happens to a person when they go on stage. But
I'm so into the era that they are portraying. It's just, it's everything to me. It's just beautiful. I think she's a little dirtier than comedians were at that time as far as language, but I mean, that's the smallest little, I just think that show is A+ all the way.
Yeah. I think it's fabulous and tremendous.
It's tremendous.
And marvelous even.
Yeah. It's all three of them. I mean, they do such a good, here's a very interesting factoid for you.
Okay.
The creator of that show, Amy Sherman-Palladino, is the daughter of a stand-up comedian named Don Sherman. You can still see his act on YouTube. At the end of his life, he was playing a lot of cruise ships, which where a lot of comedians, that's how it all ends. You're doing right. cruise ships. And yeah, so she, if anyone knows that world, Amy certainly does.
The other thing is that it's like a musical, even though, even when I'm not talking about when they have the occasional number, but I mean, there was, mm-hmm. there was a season in the Catskills.
Yeah.
And the first episode, the whole shot is from the exterior of the house so that you can see in the different windows and doors and see people passing. And it was like being in the audience at a theater watching yeah. a play unfold. Like, in like a, it was very well choreographed, like a musical. It's an interesting show.
I said the word A+. I think it's better than an interesting show. I think it's just excellent on all counts, acting, writing, especially directing. And on top of that, the design is just ridiculous. I mean, the clothes, the whole thing is just hats off. Right. Amy Sherman Palladino and her husband and the whole team over there.
Well, there's so many names here that I wanted to get to, and there's just no way in hell that we're going to get to them all. And it's so, you start thinking there's people I haven't thought about in forever, you know, and you start going, well, we got to talk about Steve Martin or we got to talk about Eddie Murphy. And then it's like Red Fox. Oh my God. That's right. Or even Janine Garofalo, I thought was interesting that she basically shepherded in the alternative scene, which, you know, now I associate with like Maria Bamford, for instance.
Yes. I mean, Maria Bamford is in the first kind of like docuseries called The Comedians of Comedy. Do you remember that at all?
Thanks to your book, I'm going to go watch it. I never watched it, but I watched her sitcom. I've seen her live several times. Oh, like, I love
her. You're so lucky. I just think she's genius. I think she's incredible. Yeah. I'm thrilled that I'm in the same business as Maria Bamford. Like, that's the way
everyone's doing these virtual comedy shows right now. And she's doing a virtual slumber party where you buy a $10 ticket. She does an hour of stand-up, then she reads a bedtime story, and then she goes to sleep, apparently on camera. And then if you're still around, if you're watching the stream in the morning, she will eat breakfast with you. I mean, I think that's like the most brilliant thing I maybe have ever heard. That is just such a great
event. You know, the guy that split the atom might be a little...
In comedy.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I thought you said you ever heard. Okay.
But. I don't know. I just, you know, everyone tries to do something kind of special or some stunt or I don't know, just to get attention or whatever. And I'm not saying she's necessarily doing it for that, but just in terms of ways that people are using Zoom right now in the past year.
Yes.
This takes the cake, you know?
Now, like I said, genius. So I'm not surprised. Yeah. She could come up with like a great, unique, funny, fascinating way to work on some stand-up and do some performance theater. I mean, I guess sleeping is performance theater now.
The other thing I discovered recently, and this this guy hung out with Janine Garofalo, is Dr. Z.
Yes.
I think I heard about it on a podcast like first, and I'm like, oh my God, I wish I was in LA to go see this thing. And now they're dropping on YouTube every week, like a little 15-minute show. And it's hilarious. Even my wife, who hates Planet of the Apes, my wife was just rolling because of, you know, the material.
Of course, it's Dana Gould. He's been great since the 80s. Yeah. Like, yeah, so good. Yes. I love it. I love that he tried it. I love the way he executed the whole thing. I mean, yes, we're in agreement.
I love that. I think, and I'm reading into this, but in my mind, he's just, he's a geek like me. He bought himself a Dr. Zaius costume, and then he found a way to exploit it. No.
He hires the guy that did the original Planet of the Apes. It takes like 3 hours to get into that thing. God. You can't buy with that. That is a makeup artist.
Well, Dana has more money than I do, clearly. And better contacts.
I mean, you can get a Zaius mask and stuff, but not that looks like that.
So he doesn't own any of it, like the vest or the
hands? That's a good question. That's a good question. That he may own, but certainly that whole thing. Because I've done that show with him live, and he's there like at 2 o'clock for a 7 o'clock show.
Yeah. Oh, geez.
Yeah. It's a real, but it's, I have to say, I feel like it's worth it. Like, he kills it.
I mean, and it should be on Adult Swim. I don't know what's or maybe this is better because it's all, you know, he owns every piece of it, I'm sure, but
I don't know.
I could see people watching that. We probably should talk about, I mean, there's so much, the 80s comedy boom.
I love it. Anything.
Comics on strike. But let's talk about the Chitlin circuit. Explain that to people. And how did we go from, and I think these are not tied that closely, or maybe they are, but the Apollo was once exclusively for white audiences.
Yep. Before it was called the Apollo. Yes. It was a burlesque house. Yep.
Okay.
Built in 1914.
And so what is the Chitlin circuit?
The Chitlin circuit was, this is the unfortunate story of America. Just like in baseball, there was white baseball and what they call the Negro Leagues, African-American baseball, okay?
And this was 14 years after the color barrier was broken in baseball, which shocked me that it took that long.
Yes, as a rule, and here's a little ugly secret about the Catskill Mountains that everyone loves to talk about so much. They wouldn't really book black comics up there at the Catskills, major nightclubs. If you were working maybe with a like an African-American act, you could maybe open for them, but there was no, you couldn't really headline like there's something called presentation houses on up and down Broadway and 7th Avenue. That wasn't part of it. And so you were kind of like siloed into these clubs that were for African-Americans. And it was called the Chitlin Circuit. It's the remnants of it still exist to this day. So that's where Red Fox worked. And that's where a guy named Slappy White worked. And that's where a guy named Nipsey Russell worked. And these and Moms Mabley obviously was like the queen of this circuit. And then luckily in 1960, there was a great comedian named Dick Gregory in Chicago. Great comic. And Hugh Hefner of the Playboy Club has a new club in Chicago. And they book comedians. He's like, let's bring in Dick Gregory. And he performs in front of an all-white crowd. And he has really smart material about race relations. Basically, all of his jokes are about that. The crowd eats it up. Time magazine hears about it. They write a profile of him. Next thing you know, New York Times, Esquire magazine, late night comedy. I'm sure when you were a kid, it was like Letterman and Leno and stuff. But back then it was Jack Parr. It was like, hey, Dick Gregory, I'd love to have you on the show. He goes, yeah, I will do your show. I will do the Tonight Show with Jack Parr on NBC 11:30 at night. If you let me sit down on the panel, because I notice whenever you have a black performer on there, they get to sing or dance or do something, but then they never get to sit down and chat like a full human being. And Parr's like, is that true? He goes, yeah, it's true. And I'm not going to do your show unless I can do a panel. And he was like, you got it. And that's how he did the show. He sat down, did the show numerous times. And he went from work, you know, before he was whatever, he was like, I don't know, $50 a week or something before he was did the Playboy Club to like, you know, 12 grand a week or something. He was just on his way. And that opened the door to nightclubs and television shows and late night television, booking more and more African-American comics. One of the biggest beneficiaries of that was Moms Mabley, who is sort of this legend of the circuit, of the Chitlin circuit. Now she released an album and sold like a million copies and people just loved her. And so for the last, you know, 12 years of her life, she was like this incredible force of stand-up. So, you know, it was a sad thing, but that's what happened. Is that the way I wrote it in the book?
That's pretty close to how you wrote it in the book.
Okay.
I didn't really think about the fact that was so important. I thought of it in terms of comedy. I was so tunnel visioned and that opened the door for every performer.
But here's the amazing thing. Within 4 years of Dick Gregory breaking the color line there at the Playboy Club in January 1961, you have Bill Cosby comes along and he blows up in the hugest way. And then right on his tail, Richard Pryor does his first Ed Sullivan show in 1965. Although I will say that Ed Sullivan did use a burlesque-esque black comedian by the name of Pig Meat Markham, who mainly did sketches.
Which now sounds like a Twitter handle.
Yeah. So he did use him before Dick Gregory. And also, There was an African-American impressionist by the name of George Kirby, who was on Toast of the Town in the 40s, in 1949, I think. So, which is the early version of the Ed Sullivan Show. So it's not like there was none on television, or there was none, right. But it was just, it wasn't, it was really an exception. That was a really incredible moment. And then, you know, it's just a... From Cosby on, it was just great. We've just had so many great comedians of every color.
I was going to say Red Fox, the thing, another interesting tidbit for people is, idea of party records, this idea that people would bring friends over and throw on a piece of vinyl and stand around or sit around and share that experience.
Yep.
Now seems very quaint. I mean, it's hard to imagine it, but I thought that was very cool.
Well, when you were a kid, did you ever have comedy records?
I didn't really. Other than Steve Martin, I don't think I ever played them with other friends.
But you did have at least one moment where you had friends listening to Steve Martin.
That's true. But it was more music.
So, you know, we were still dealing with like profanity and obscenity and where we draw the line and what's acceptable in society and do we want our kids hearing this? And like we were dealing with all of that stuff at that time, not just in stand up, in movies, in books, in poetry. I'm going to use the word howl, in plays, you know, Tennessee Williams and stuff. So we were just kind of grappling with like, all right, what is a society are we going to allow to say? And then, you know, there's no one who exploited the hypocrisy of that more than George Carlin, who got famous writing this routine called The 7 Words You Can Never Say on Television. But the fact is, that list didn't really exist. It was just understood you can't say the MF compound word on television.
And he was jailed, right? Did he spend a night in jail?
I don't think he spent a night in jail, but he was arrested in Milwaukee. Yeah.
Okay. And that goes back, like, even Mae West got into trouble.
8 days in jail. Eight days.
And now you say the wrong thing, you might get, quote unquote, canceled. But cancel culture really is nothing new. The name is new, but, I mean, people have always been trying to shut down people they disagree with or people that are using language they don't care for.
Right. It used to be much more from the conservative side of society, well, like the Catholic League and all of that. And now it's all from the more liberal side of society. So it's just interesting how that's flipped in my lifetime.
It is bizarre. Lots more to talk about with comedian Wayne Fetterman, author of the brand new book, The History of Stand-Up, From Mark Twain to Dave Chappelle, right after this.
Artificial intelligence is getting smarter all the time. The line between man and machine is blurring. In the coming robot wars, it will be more important than ever to prove that you are human.
That's why you need the new I'm Not a Robot t-shirt from the Daily Detour Tee Public Shop. The I'm Not a Robot shirt tells the world that you're flesh and blood. You have feelings. And you can successfully count the number of traffic lights in a photograph. No? Try again with these crosswalks. Still haven't got it? All right, how about these bicycles? There you go! See, you're human. The I'm Not a Robot t-shirt. Verify your humanity today at the Daily Detour Tee Public Shop. Link to the store in today's episode description. Yep, grab one of those t-shirts. They're comfy, they're cozy, and it may just be the most important thing that you do today for yourself. Unless you're getting vaccinated. In which case, vaccination takes top priority, and then the shirt, that would be number two on the list. I'm pretty sure that's it. You're listening to this podcast, so really, what else have you got going on? Anyway, I hope you're enjoying today's show. Here's the conclusion to our history of stand-up conversation and lesson with professor at USC and comedian and actor Wayne Fetterman. You mentioned Cosby a lot. I enjoyed, you know, Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids and the Cosby Show and the album that you reference. What is it,
Bill Cosby? I referenced 6 of his albums.
Well, he had a run.
If I'm not mistaken, he had the longest run of consecutive Grammy wins for comedy albums all during the 60s. And those are all before your time. But there's a whole generation of people who's just like, Bill Cosby is a very funny fellow, right? Yeah. And why is there air? And to my brother, Russell, I slept with, like, those albums are just iconic, like huge, multi-million selling albums.
Well,
every year he would come out with a new one.
He himself, for sure, was iconic. So you got Cosby in his current situation. You've got Woody Allen. He's in jail. Yeah.
Cosby is in jail right now. If he's listening to this, he is in jail. So,
and I mean, you got Louis C.K. Stunning,
but I couldn't. This is the thing is I write in the very beginning of the book that I can't tell the history of stand up without mentioning some of these guys whose behavior. And I think this is the quote. Tell me if I have it wrong. Range from reprehensible to detestable to illegal, their offstage behavior. And I hope hearing their names doesn't ruin this story.
Right.
And that's all I could do. I mean, yeah. So I didn't want it. So every time I mention Louis C.K., I didn't want to go, who later was accused of this. And, you know, I didn't want to get into all of that. Although I do mention that when Bill Cosby went to jail, because one of the reasons he went to jail is because another comedian called him out.
Right.
A guy named Hannibal Buress.
Right.
Yeah. That I thought was an ironic twist to the whole situation.
Well, because that was a dirty little secret that was like a rumor within the comedy.
It wasn't a secret, but it was sort of kept under wraps. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a secret to middle, like to mom and dad America, but within the industry of comedy, it was not a secret. Yeah.
Interesting, huh?
Well, it is.
I find it interesting. I hope somebody finds this interesting other than me.
The listeners will care for sure. Okay. How are we supposed to process a Bill Cosby or a Louis C.K.?
It's up to you.
Yeah. What about Drybar? Are they an important force?
Yes, they are. They are huge. They looked at what was happening on Netflix and looked at it like, and you know, it's very adult. All of those specials tend to be adult, except maybe Gaffigan or Regan. And we're like, there's been no one who's branded clean comedy specials. And there's a bunch of comics who were clean. They started taping these shows in Provo, Utah.
Right.
Probably the most ethnically diverse place on the planet, Provo, Utah. And huge. Yeah. Anyway, so they go there and they tape them and they figure out a marketing strategy using Facebook to move these products. And they're killing it, those guys over there.
Yeah.
Millions of hits. These comedians can now tour and they can, you know, their music is on Sound Exchange. Excuse me. Their comedy bits are on Sound Exchange and it's just great. And then there's another streaming service that just clean comedians. Can't think of it. Something Flicks, Clean Flicks or something like that, which is mainly Christian comics. And
interesting.
But there's a number of only Christian comics that have their own. They tour churches. They play churches.
Right.
Like, you've seen those big churches like. That's a big gig.
They kind of examined that on Crashing with Pete Holmes. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yep. Yep. Yep.
See, I'm a comedy nerd. I swear to you.
Crashing.
Crashing. I'm so disappointed that it's not going on. But it's great. You could rewatch it. It's good stuff.
Thank you. Did you know I was on that?
I don't remember that, but it's been a couple years. I know.
This
there I go again.
Humiliating.
You were marvelous, tremendous, and fabulous.
Don't try to make up for it. Don't try to make up for it. Too late.
Is Netflix producing too many stand-up specials? I've heard that criticism a lot. Like people that aren't ready necessarily for that moment. Is it good or bad, or it's having no effect?
I don't. That's a different kind of. That I have no comment on that. I do think that Netflix is a very important player in the history of stand-up. If I wasn't going from using names, if I didn't go from Twain to Chappelle, I would have gone from like minstrel shows to Netflix. Like they are the standard now.
It's another interesting thing. I don't want to, like, I'm just going to say this. You don't have to comment on this, but it is interesting to not just go hop from name to name or time to time, but to watch the geography of it spread out from the Catskills to Las Vegas to Los Angeles and New York.
Miami Beach. Don't forget Miami Beach. Huge.
It is a history lesson. It is a cool history, but it's fun.
It's right there on the title.
Wayne, you got a lot of comedians in your book. Is there anybody that you, now that it's published, did you forget anybody? Were you worried about forgetting anybody?
Well, yeah, there's a few, you know, there's just so many great comedians. I just didn't want to list every comedian, but yeah. I mean, there was a guy named Dennis Wolfberg, who was just a wonderful guy. Roger Ray from the 50s. I mean, I could go on and on. like hundreds of these guys. There's in New York, there's a comic named Dan Natterman that I just love, and it's ridiculous. And I hope I didn't hurt anyone's feelings.
And there's a great timeline in the back of the book, too. So if you don't want to read the 160 pages, you can just read two or three pages as well.
Yeah, exactly.
The book is The History of Stand-Up.
What's the whole title? What's the whole title?
The History of Stand-Up, from Mark Twain to Dave Chappelle. You can buy it right now. There will be a link in the audio description of this podcast. It'll take you right to the book.
It's not that pricey. It's not like some $25, $30 book or something. No.
It's like 11, $12. Nine, it's under 11, $12. Nine, and the Kindle is under $9, I believe.
Yeah. I make it easy. I'm not here to exploit, take your money.
Yeah.
Except a little bit of it. Just a little bit of it.
What's next?
I remember.
Go ahead.
There was a comedian named Robert Schimmel. Do you know who that is? He was a dirty comic in the 80s, but he had a great album. I think it was either album or special. I just mention him in the book. Don't really talk about him. It was like, buy my CD so I can buy this car. Like, it was so great.
Blatant or blunt.
Yeah, it was just so funny. Like, buy this CD so I can buy this car.
He's no longer with us, is he?
That is correct. Yeah.
He died of cancer and he.
No, he didn't. Know. He beat cancer and then died in a car accident. It's.
Oh, that is. That is effed up.
Yeah. No, really. And he just had a great matter-of-fact style about him and casual throwaway, and it was dirty stuff and did specials. And I just loved it. A lot of Lettermans, and I just missed the guy tremendously. But I just loved the name of that album. It was just like comedians, I feel like, have that. You can be so truthful, like, buy this CD so I can buy this car. Like, that's what's better than that.
What is next for you? I know you have a stand-up special that's coming.
Yeah, no. But the big thing is I'm working on a George Carlin documentary for HBO. I'm co-producing that with Judd Apatow. So that is going to be, it's thrilling to work on it. It's not fun. It's thrilling. I love every aspect of his career, even when he was the angry guy at the end. And obviously one of the greatest to ever stand on stage with a microphone doing stand-up.
100%. Well, how far, like, are you guys in the editing booth on this? Or are you still?
No,
like,
I mean, that's not true. We are early, but I would say probably 1 year from now, probably March or April of 2022.
And I love the Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling. And I have the book. I have the book as well.
You have the book.
I do. It's all good stuff. I had no idea till I read Judd's Sick in the Head book, like how the word Zen came up then. And I had no idea how philosophical Gary Shandling was.
He was really on a search. He was on a search, that guy. And I was thrilled to play his brother on the show and equally honored to work on that documentary. Like, that was, it's a career highlight for me.
And what about Kenny Rogers? I'll let you go.
He's late. I love doing it. We end up basically talking about, you know, he sort of helped bring the Eagles together because he produced Don Henley's first album, and Don Henley lived with him when Henley came from Texas, and talked a lot about playing bass. I don't know if you know that he was a bass player, and it's just one. It was just a wonderful afternoon of shooting that ridiculous Geico commercial.
Right.
I was sad. Yeah, it was really fun. Really fun.
I actually liked his, I was a kid, so forgive me, but I think I watched every one of his Gambler movies with Bruce Boxleitner. So, you know.
How many of those movies? There was like three of them or
something? There was at least three.
Yeah.
I feel like there could be something after that. Anyway, Wayne, thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me on the show. I hope this was a good detour for today.
So that was like a podcast. If there's a podcast bucket list, I just put a check mark next to that one because loved his History of Stand-Up podcast series, mini series, if you will, limited series. Always enjoy Wayne Fetterman whenever he makes an appearance somewhere. So that was cool. I reached out, took my shot. He said yes, and there you go. And the book, The History of Stand-Up, it's a nice, like he said, it's 160 pages, so it's an easy read, quick read. And yet there's so much of it that we did not talk about today. So if you're into this whole comedy thing, the history of stand-up, it's well worth your time. Nice to have on the bookshelf. It might be a good reference for trivia night or whatever. So there you have it. At the top of the show, I mentioned that stand-up is coming back. Mentioned I'm getting my second vaccine soon, and I guess it's a couple weeks after that I'll be fully immune, or as immune as I'm going to be. And I'm thinking that I may work up the guts to do some open mics. Again, I've done them before, but it's actually been a while. So if you're in Spokane, you've been warned. You've been warned. And I apologize in advance for anything I say that might offend you. All right, that's it for today's episode. Next time, we'll be joined by filmmaker David Weiner, whose documentary In Search of Darkness is making its Shudder debut.
When you look back years later, you can see the longevity of these characters, the endurance of these characters, you know, whether you're Pinhead or Chucky or Leatherface or Michael Myers, they've stood the test of time.
Until then, have a great week, chase your dreams, and remember the Daily Detour motto. We have a motto? I guess we have a motto. Curiosity, comedy, creativity, and kindness. Words to live by.
You've been listening to The Daily Detour, a production of Basic Bits LLC, hosted by Dan Roberts. Music by Quickie. And I'm your announcer, Libet Wolf. New episodes drop Monday through Friday. Subscribe now so you never miss a moment. And we'll chat with you next time.
Hi! Hi!